The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey, guys. Welcome back to Breaking Banks. We are live from New York City and got some great stuff for you today. We're going to be talking to Square about their new EMV NFC-enabled payment capability, their new tool they're bringing out. We're going to be talking also to our old pal Robert Scoble. Hopefully we'll be back to talk about some of the developments in technologies like augmented reality, drones, some of the new phones he's been checking out, stuff like that. He's really got his finger on the pulse over there, so that'll be fantastic to hear from the Scobalizer. If you don't already follow Robert, then make a habit of following his Facebook feed, because if you want to find out about some of the amazing stuff that's going on, then that's where you can find out. He was at Stanford Research Institute, SRI, who developed Siri, earlier this week, checking out some of the interesting developments in sort of powered exoskeletons and voice recognition and stuff. It's very interesting, so we'll probably get into that. In the news... for you guys, it's interesting. Some of the news on Goldman Sachs, they're having a hiring spree in Warsaw around technology. Why Warsaw, Poland? I don't know. Maybe it's part of the EU, so they have some protection of the EU regulations and so forth. But in addition to that, Poland has the highest contactless penetration in the world, so. That could be part of the reason. They're also quite a young population. So, but in news on Goldman Sachs, it also came out this week that there is a firm in Shenzhen, in China, which is called Goldman Sachs, has an office set up in, with the same logo, same company name, Goldman Sachs Shenzhen, a fake Goldman Sachs company which has no affiliation with Goldman Sachs. This is on the back of the news we heard last week that there was a fake agricultural bank of in China, a fake branch that someone had set up and was taking deposits in China. So they're getting really, really good... with this fake stuff. So anyway, we'll be talking to Scoble after the break as well. There was also some news on Coin, as you guys have heard, the Coin card, which was a card that enabled you to program up to 6 different credit cards and debit cards and put them into one multifunction card, has had a really troubled slow start. Has had problems with production, problems with shipping. They've announced Coin 2.0, which is an NFC-enabled card. I'm definitely going to ask Jesse from... Square when he comes on later this afternoon what he thinks about that. But my view is I don't know why you would have an NFC programmable card when phones do the same thing, but we'll get into that. So talk about that. But at this point, let's welcome back Sam Maul, who's a regular on the show. Sam, welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Yeah.
So Sam, where are you? Were you in Toronto today, or where are you?
I'm actually in St. Augustine, Florida.
You're in Florida today. Okay, cool. But you have coming up in Toronto in Canada, the Digital Finance Institute, September 30th. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we've actually, this is our second conference that we're helping host. Our first was back in June in Vancouver. Christine Duheim, who founded the Digital Finance Institute, and I'm an officer for it. We put the conference together having absolutely no clue how to put a conference together on fintech. And I remember the night before, I told her this is either going to be an unmitigated disaster or this might be kind of cool. It ended up being very cool. We sold it out. Just had a wonderful turnout and great speakers, so we thought we'd try it again. So this time, we've actually partnered with NextBank and are having a conference September 30th at the St. James Cathedral Center in Toronto. And we have just a ridiculous lineup, in all honesty. One of my two sessions in particular I'm very excited for. We've got the director of the Internet of Everything, Gino Zucca. Just for his name, you should come. He's from Cisco. And he'll be talking about the Internet of Things and how that ties in with payments. And then just for you, Brett, we're having an entire session and panel session on AI and how it impacts banking and payments. And I'm very much looking forward to that one. That one should be interesting. Cool. We've also got great speakers. Yeah, I know you'd like that one. Good plug for your book. This actually came out in our conference in Vancouver. We talked quite a bit about AI and didn't expect that to come up as a topic. And it struck a chord with quite a few people. We also have one of my favorites, Scarlett Sibier from BBVA, from their innovation team will be there. Scarlett is fantastic. Daniel Eberhard from Coho. There's actually quite a few startups in fintech out of Vancouver. For some reason, Vancouver's become a hotspot. Which I knew nothing about back in June. But the Coho, Daniel Eberhard in payments, Michael Gortek in PayPerma. And then right down the street, I think, from you, Brett, Joe Lang, who's from R3CEV, which is a cryptocurrency company that our friend Simon Taylor from Barclays introduced me to her.
Sounds like a good lineup. I was reading an article, actually, earlier today about Uber's challenges in Canada. And, of course, it's banned in two of the major cities. I think it's banned in Quebec and Montreal because of bylaws, taxi bylaws, and there's challenges in the rest of it. But it was interesting take on why startups have struggles in Canada. Because of some of the regulatory environment, so I should tweet out that article on the stream because I thought it was an interesting discussion about the challenges of being a startup in Canada. So, but it'd be good to see. Sounds like a good lineup. So, in terms of some of the other work you're working on, Sam, you've been interviewing some of the power women in fintech. Tell us about some of the interesting people we should be watching. Some of the power women in fintech we should be keeping an eye on.
That's been a fun project. That's been partnered with InnoTribe, our good friends there, and Swift. This is actually leading up to Sibos in Singapore. We partnered with them. Christine and I authored a white paper back in June and published it, and the response has been unbelievable. My original goal was only to list about 100 women in the fintech space.
How many?
As of now, I'm pushing 1,000 easily. Interviewed. Really two great interviews yesterday. I spoke with Anna Marie Jung, who's the head of Amazon's EU Payments Group, who, one, is just fascinating. She's originally from Luxembourg, so I learned Luxembourgese is an actual language, which I had no clue. And she is absolutely brilliant. I also spoke with Leslie Berland from Amex, who, if you have done any reading around social and fintech integration, Leslie's been near and dear to that. I've been driving that since about 2010. And the list just goes on and on. Jo Lang, like I said, who I mentioned before, she's actually one that I profiled. So we're getting ready to publish via DFI site a list similar. I based it on a website, Humans of New York, if you're familiar with that.
We've
created a site. And we're tweaking it right now, but it'll be at DFI. We'll have, at this pace, 70-plus interviews with women all across the globe from different companies, all in fintech, and it's really their voice and views. We'll have our good friend Dwayne Blomstrom will be on there. All of our friends from the fintech mafia and such will be included. And I would encourage everyone to read that because I think your perceptions of women in the space and what they're doing and what they're creating, I think a lot of us are misinformed, I think is the best way to put it.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, that's great. Thanks for coming back on the show, giving us an update. When are you going to be at Sibos in Singapore in October?
I will be. My first trip to Singapore. So I'll stay in the Brett King suite if I can.
There you go. So that's October 11, 12 through 14, I think, right?
Correct. Yep.
Okay, great. Well, look, we'll catch you down there. Breaking Banks will be down in Singapore for that, so it'll be good to catch up with you there.
Right. I'll look forward to seeing you there, Brett.
Thanks for the update, Sam. Okay, next up, Stéphane Dubois, who's the CEO of Exit. Is that how I say it, Stéphane?
That's how you say it. Good job.
And you were recently named to the Institutional Investor's Tech 50 list of financial visionaries and innovators. We don't often get into sort of the institutional stuff, but you guys are working, of course, in market data in the cloud. You've done stuff with you talked with Forbes and Markets Media, Wall Street, and technology, financial news, etc. And you speak over the world. But tell us a little bit more about what's happening in this market data cloud space right now and what Exignite is doing.
Sure. A lot of what we do is focused on the fintech space. If you think about what's happening in the fintech world, which has only been around for a couple of years or so, at least really coming on the forefront of the market, a lot of it has been, in the works for the last 5-6 years. A lot of the robo-advisors and some other companies have been cooking up some new recipes for financial services for about that amount of time. We actually started a little bit before that, really trying to reinvent a little bit what was happening in the world of market data. Market data is the lifeblood of finance. If you're going to do anything related to financial services, you're going to need financial market data. And actually, we started the company wanting to be a wealth manager, and we couldn't find market data that was easy to consume. You had to go to some of the old traditional vendors, firms like Thomson Reuters and Bloomberg, and you had a lot of legacy technology, a lot of very expensive stuff. And so what we started doing is bringing some simple concepts such as easy APIs, which back in the days really nobody knew what we were talking about, and the cloud, to really make it easy to consume market data and build applications with it. And actually what happened is that a lot of those fintech companies really started adopting our technology because they were trying to create new models, create new businesses, create new experiences, build mobile applications and whatnot. And they didn't really want to deal with this old legacy technology. So they were very quick to embrace the cloud, to embrace APIs. And now, today, we find ourselves powering a very, very large universe of fintech firms. So we really have most of the firms you're familiar with just using us to do that.
Would know. Talk about some of the fintech companies that we might know and also the data they're typically using.
Sure. I'm sure you have talked about the robo-advisors, which is really the poster child segment of the fintech industry. Firms like Wealthfront, firms like Personal Capital of Betterment, or Future Advisor, which was just announced to be bought by BlackRock yesterday. One of the second large financial institutions buying a robo-advisor. All those firms really started building their technology and their platform using us. You have other firms like Motif Investing, Square, who is going to be talking a little bit after, uses us as well. We have about 1,000 firms who use us today all around the world, and I would say probably 200-300 of those are actually fintech companies, right? And a lot of them will be brands and names that you recognize, either in the investment management space, the robo-advisor space, the payment space, the personal financial management space. These are a lot of the companies who use us.
And so what's the data? What's the data they're using?
Sure. So a lot of it is essentially information about investments, about securities. So you're talking about quotes on securities coming from the markets. You're talking about, you know, historical pricing information, reference data, anything that you need to be able to, you know, either power an accounting system or a decision support system, or you know, companies like Robinhood, for example, use us for trading. You know, same for companies like eToro in Europe that does a lot of, you know, revolutionized trading, online trading. It uses us as well. Companies like StockTwits, I'm sure you're familiar with, also use us to, you know, feed and illustrate and enhance a lot of the feed information using our data.
Yeah. So, tell me a little bit about how you work with these. You know, what's the cycle? How long does it take a fintech company to get up to speed and get plugged into this data?
Well, it really takes just a few minutes. You know, that's the thing about using the cloud and using APIs, that literally, you know, we can show you and how we can, you know, in writing a few lines of code, you can start pulling data in an app and display it and deliver it to thousands of users. You know, typically we work with fintech companies as they're building their platform, they're building their business. So we work with them through their development cycles. You know, people use us to build new things. So it might take, you know, weeks for them to finish their development process, but the actual process of integrating our data with their technology just takes minutes or hours or days versus the traditional, you know, months of work and you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of hardware and software that you had to spend to be able to do the same thing before.
So, how do people find out about your suite of products and how to work with you guys?
Well, we got started by making good use of the internet, right? A lot of people found us because they Googled us up and they found us. And now, because so many firms use us, so many well-known brands in the fintech world use us, and we're very much on the circuit, you know, speaking everywhere, meeting all the innovators in all the cities you were talking about, whether it's Singapore or London or Australia. You know, we get a huge amount of business this way. But also what we're seeing is that now, you know, for a while, the large banks, going back to the topic of your show, right, the large banks used to ignore a lot of this in the early days. And, you know, they were used to spend a huge amount of money on market data. And when they looked at our technology, they're like, you know, that seems like a toy almost. But now that their business is threatened by the robo-advisors, by emerging players that are just reinventing finance, they're really taking a hard look at things. Yeah, saying, right. should we use this technology as well? Because the cost advantage and the time-to-market advantage that you get as a result is drastically different.
And
the cost structure. Go ahead.
We're all moving to that real time and, you know, the immediacy. It's all very important. So, listen, I want to just get to Scoble just quickly before the break, Stefan. So what's the website where we can find that information?
www.xignite.com.
And, of course, you're on LinkedIn and Twitter, are you?
Yes, on Twitter, S. Dubois, S-D-U-B-O-I-S.
Okay, great. So, and we've tweeted out your name with this, too. So thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you very much, Brett.
Robert, you there on? Robert Scoble.
Yeah.
Hey,
thanks
you sound very quiet there, dude.
I'm loud as I can be.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not sure, Matt, if you can pump up the volume on Robert, but we might just sort this out over the break. But we're going to come back with Robert in a moment, Robert Scoble, the Scobleizer. We're going to talk about some of the developments out on the West Coast and some of the tech he's been looking at over the last few weeks. We'll just take a quick break, and we'll be right back after the break.
It's been probably the best thing we've ever done, without a doubt.
In 2011, Duane Blomstrom and Maniga headed to the first Finovate in Europe.
We were a very small company back then, 6 people. We had decided that we're going to actually demo, which was a big step for a small company at that time.
After winning Best of Show, they grew to be a European market leader in personal financial management.
Pipeline essentially exploded as a result of this. It essentially put us on the map.
So why do they keep going back to Finovate?
It keeps us honest innovation-wise.
Register today for Finovate Spring 2015 in San Jose on May 12th and 13th and experience future fintech first.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, you're back with Brett King, and this is Breaking Banks. Just before the break, we had Robert Scoble join us. Robert, welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on.
It's always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure. Now, you've been checking out some really interesting stuff. You've been at SRI earlier in the week. Was that this week, or it might have been last week?
Yeah. No, that was Monday, yeah. For people who don't know what SRI is, this is probably the most important research and development lab in the world. It's where the internet was developed, where HDTV was developed, where the mouse was developed, where robotic surgery was developed, a bunch of other things. But most of their work is for the government. So, you know, if the government needs something, they put out a request for bid through, like, DARPA or other agencies. And these guys will, or girls, will bid on it. And that's why we have the Internet, right? The Internet was originally developed for the military at this lab, and it's a real honor to get to tour it, because you see stuff that's pretty mind-blowing.
And you were checking out an exoskeleton or powered exoskeleton suit, huh? What did it feel like?
Yeah, so they're building robots to assist, you know, for soldiers, but now that technology is being declassified, they're trying to make consumer applications about with it. This exoskeleton was designed to assist the soldier who's carrying a 100-pound pack and help him walk so that he gets the ability to walk further without getting fatigued, or she will be able to walk further without getting fatigued. And now they're thinking about, could we bring this into the consumer world and help a backpacker or help a FedEx delivery person who needs to lift heavy weights or walk long distances, that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's a few companies working on this. There's 3D Systems and Esco Bionics that are doing some of this. And we've seen, we saw one of these units used in, was it the start of the World Cup with a paralyzed person with an exoskeleton kicking the soccer ball? Do you remember that?
I met several of these companies over the years. One of the ones, the exoskeleton company, helps paraplegics walk around upright, and it's quite revolutionary. But I didn't remember the soccer ball thing.
Yeah. And obviously Japan is looking at these sort of technologies as well. They're focused on this. What are some of the other stuff you've seen over the last few weeks? I know you had is it Odi, the new mobile phone?
Or Obi? Yeah, that was launched last night. Now most people in America won't really care about this, but if you're in Vietnam or many other countries, and you're just now getting a smartphone, you probably can't afford $1,000 iPhone. And so they're taking the iPhone technology and the design sensibilities and bringing it to the rest of the world for less than $200, and that's a pretty interesting new company. They're competing with a whole range of companies out of China. Xiaomi is probably the most popular competitor doing similar kinds of things, trying to bring highly designed iPhone-like devices to the rest of the world for a very, very low cost.
Now, where do you put it in terms of the equivalent iPhone models? Where would you rank it? Is that a fair assessment?
Probably like last year's model, I would say, but it's $200. It has a nice screen. It feels nice. It's fairly fast. It has the latest electronics, and it has good audio. But it's less than, they have two models less than $200. And so, if you start thinking about a world where you don't have a phone subsidy, like we're moving into, Verizon just signaled that they're canceling their phone subsidies. An iPhone, a high-end iPhone, is more than $1,000. I paid more than $1,000 for my last iPhone 6 Plus. Most people are not able to, around the world, are not able to afford that kind of thing. So the real action is in the sub-$200 Android phones, and who has the best designed one in that category is going to gain market share, I believe.
Well, the new Nokia equivalent, and this is pretty key, because all these estimates about 80% of the world's population having a smartphone by 2020, is contingent on us having these rich feature phones and smartphones at an affordable price point. But that's Moore's law again at play here, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely, and it just keeps coming down. I mean, these phones now are way better than the first iPhones I had. They're faster, they have better cameras, they have better screens, they have a better design, and they're a lot cheaper than my first iPhone was. So it's pretty interesting. In India alone, they sell a million smartphones a day, and that gives you an idea of the scale of this new mobile industry. And if a company like Obi Mobile can take a few percent of market share, that's a pretty nice number.
Yeah, absolutely. Now you've also been privileged to get a look behind the scenes, some of which you can't talk about here, but some of which you can, on some of the new VR rigs that are coming out and things like that. And you posted also yesterday something about some augmented virtuality, which for those of you that sort of try to understand this space, we have VR, which is full immersive virtual reality environments where you put your VR goggles on and you're in a complete virtual environment. You have augmented reality, which is, and Robert, of course, is famous for his depiction of Google Glass in the shower, which has been immortalized in a patent recently.
Patent is, by the way, for a really interesting company called Magic Leap, which Google invested $500 million in, and nobody's even seen this thing. So that demo must be a really amazing demo. And in fact, the people I've talked to who have seen it say it is an amazing demo. Ted Shulowitz, the futurist down at 20th Century Fox, the movie company, said it's Google's first $1 trillion idea. What it is you're going to wear a glass around the real world, and it's going to put virtual items into the real world. So think about, walking around, being able to see zombies on the street and having to shoot them, or seeing information about, when you ask it, where should I go for lunch, it'll put it right in your view. It'll say, hey, go to this place. It's the best Mexican place in town, Or on and on. The developers who are thinking about this new augmented reality world, and Magic Leap is hardly the only one building glasses and building things for it, is completely open. It's the time for developers to dream again, and that's quite exciting to watch that. You know, normal people probably won't have it for 5 to 7, maybe even a decade, 5 to 7 years, but the labs are building some amazing things.
Yeah, I saw yesterday on the Facebook feed someone with a Oculus Rift kit hooked up to a full body thing which simulated flying, which was pretty interesting.
Yeah, you know, you're going to see a lot of playing around just to see where the edges of this new virtual technology. I think next year is all about virtual reality, by the way. The Magic Leap is fun to think about, but, you know, and Microsoft HoloLens is in there. We're going to see that next year, but it's going to be too expensive and not, and there's not going to be enough immersive experiences to really get most people excited. But virtual reality is going to come on big in the first quarter of next year. Oculus. So there's three premium headsets that you're going to watch. Oculus Rift from Facebook. Valve has a headset that they're developing with HTC called Vive. And Sony has this headset called Morpheus. And these three headsets are extremely low latency, really immersive. They are stunning. And if you can get a demo on one, do it, because it's the most mind-blowing thing you've ever seen.
So what was the moment for you?
It gives you vertigo when you stand on top of something. I mean, I could go on for an hour about this stuff.
When was the moment when you put a VR headset on and you realized it was a game changer?
When I had a party at CES this year, and two guys walked in with a 360 camera and a headset, and they said, put this on. And I'd already been sold on it, because I'd seen the Oculus demos, and it was just got me excited at Web Summit last year. But at CES, they said, put this on, and they put me into a video where I was going down the Grand Canyon on a river raft, and I instantly started falling physically, because my mind was trying to counteract the motion of the raft. And I said, damn, this is going to be big, because that was on the Samsung Galaxy, Samsung Gear VR headset, which is a $200 headset. And if a $200 headset can do that to me, wait until you see what the $1,500 to $3,000 headsets do. And in fact, I just got a tour 2 weeks ago of Oculus's labs, and they showed me some of the stuff that they're doing, and it's just absolutely mind-blowing. It is the most exciting thing I've seen in a long time.
But you need some pretty powerful computing power to power that low latency.
Yeah, and that's why it's $1,500, because, you know, maybe the headset's $500, but you need a decent PC with a decent NVIDIA GPU on it. And the way my friend says, you know, you're not going to buy the $1,500 one, you're going to buy the $3,000 one, because that's where the bleeding edge of the gamer machines are. And whenever you find a teenager who's really pushing gaming and playing these new PC games, they're playing with a $2,000, $3,000 system. Maybe even with two NVIDIA GPU cards, you know, the high-end ones of which are $600 a piece, something like that. So,
yeah, check out the check out the Alienware Area 51, man.
Yeah, you know, there's a whole range of PCs that are aimed at this high-end video gamer kind of person, and that's what it's going to take to really blow your mind with VR, because VR is sort of like a video game, but it wraps all the way around you. And as you look around, you see a world, right? And that requires a lot of GPU to do some of the more mind-blowing stuff. The Samsung Gear VR is going to do a whole range of things, but it's going to be fine for many consumers. But, you know, those of us who are nerds, who love having the latest thing to show off to the kids, you know, we're going to be buying a $1,500 to $3,000, $4,000 setup, and maybe even two of them, because Oculus showed me social gaming worlds where you are participating in a world with other people who are also alive and participating in that world, and it's quite stunning.
Yeah, cool. So listen, one of the other things, given the patent that Magic Leap did with your immortalizing your picture of yourself in the shower with the Google Glass on, it's interesting to see you've actually been profiling a shower company in California recently. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we have a real deep drought right now. It's the driest I've ever seen it in my life. I lived through a bad drought in the 70s, but this is worse. So I'm interested in companies who are going to bring products out that help us save water. And the shower company, I just forgot the name, Novia, builds a shower that uses 30% of the water of the existing shower, and it's quite interesting.
Cool. And you also, I can't find it on your Facebook feed for the moment, but you were checking out some augmented virtuality where they actually take some of the real-world objects, like your person and desks and chairs and tables, and virtualize those by projecting them into your virtual reality environment. Do you want to talk about sort of that merger of, you know, by bringing some of this...
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of funny stuff coming when we get magic... were we thinking about the Magic Leap world where we're going to have a complete blending of the virtual world and real world? Or,
well, see, or even with VR, when it's going to take some of your real-world objects into that, they merge, right?
What's that? Broke up, I'm sorry.
Yeah, with VR and sort of things like, Kinect and other stuff, sort of projecting that stuff into the virtual reality world or objectizing that in the virtual world could be interesting as well. But you're also big on the whole, some of this photography tech, drone tech, and I saw you you were checking out one photo kite earlier in the week as well.
Yesterday I saw a photo kite, which is spelled F-O-T-O, kite, and it's a drone that's on a string. And so instead of using a controller to fly the drone, you just put it up, aim it, and let it fly. And it is attached to the ground through a string. And that way you can use that drone technology in places where drones aren't allowed, like around news events, around crowds and stuff like that, because it's classified more as a kite than as a drone. And that's an interesting idea. Great for journalists and stuff like that. I still like the full-blown drones better if I can use them, you know, the DJI-style drones or the 3D robotics where you have a gimbal and the camera is really steady and you have complete control to fly it away, you know, and fly around things, stuff like that. But, yeah, there's a lot of innovation in drones. It seems like every couple of weeks I see another drone company that's doing something different, trying to build sensors that'll follow you, like if you're a skier, or the next bleeding edge is going to be object avoidance. So it automatically builds a 3D model of the world it's flying around in, and if you try to fly it into a tree, it'll say, hey, that's not a really bright idea. You know? So they're building radars into them. And in fact, when you talk about Amazon. Amazon's building drones to try to deliver things and maybe go to the last the curb to the home problem where you might have a self-driving car deliver a package, but that's only to the curb. How do you get the package from the curb to your front door? Well, you have to have something that delivers it, and maybe a drone might be the answer there. The real innovation that I hear from inside Amazon is the radar detectors that are being built into the drones to really build a 3D model of where it's going and be able to avoid objects like tree branches and stuff like that.
Yeah, given the technology that we're seeing being developed for the self-driving cars and so forth, this sort of Doppler and laser, you know, radar avoidance, all this stuff, it's got to be, on that same exponential curve right now in terms of development. So it's pretty interesting.
Yep.
And listen, Robert, we're going to have to take a quick break, and we got Jesse Doroguska from Square talking about their new Apple Pay reader after the break. But, hey, thanks for dropping in and saying hello to us.
There's so much happening in payments, and Square is just the start of the game. And I know you're deep in that world too, so I'm interested in hearing him as well.
Oh, cool! Thanks for sticking around. Maybe you can ask him a couple of questions.
Sure.
If you have time to stick around. All right. Let's take a quick break, guys. We'll be back with Jesse from Square.
Time. There's never enough. You just don't have the time to search out all the latest banking innovations from around the world. But the good news is, we've already done it for you at Banking Reports. 700 hours of research goes into each edition of our Global Banking Innovation Monitor. Be smarter and get one step ahead. Get Banking Reports sent quarterly to your inbox. To subscribe, follow us on Twitter at banking_reports.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's M-O-V-E-N.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey, thanks for joining us. You're listening to Breaking Banks. You can follow the progress in our discussion using the hashtag BreakingBanks on Twitter. And you can follow my Twitter ID as well, Brett King. Just a quick shout out to Jumio to thank them for their ongoing support of the show, sponsoring the show this week. And before the break, we were speaking to Robert Scoville about some of the interesting innovations he's been checking out. Right now, we'd like to welcome to the show Jesse Doraguska, who leads hardware product development at Square. Jesse, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, give us a little bit of background about yourself before, what did you do before Square?
Well, I've been an engineer for quite some time. So started as an engineer and fell in love with the intersection of engineering and design from the very beginning. Worked a variety of small companies, medium-sized companies over time, and landed at a small team called the iPod team in the early 2000s, and worked on iPod accessories with that team from the very beginning, and spent about 8 years at Apple through that meteoric rise through iPod, iPhone, and iPad, and then joined Square just about 4 years ago.
The accessories business alone is probably billions of dollars now, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Yeah. And, what attracted you about Square?
Wow, so many things. The customers we serve is an easy one. Working for small businesses, local businesses, growing businesses is a compelling customer every day. You wake up, you know who you're working for and why. You never lose track of that. It's very easy to focus on making their lives better.
So one of the challenges that everyone wanted to know how you guys were going to handle was the coming sort of EMV introduction in the United States. We've talked about it on the show before. EMV is the new chip standard for credit and debit cards. That is a global standard, but the U.S. is sort of fairly late to that party. But you know, one of the questions was how were you going to adapt to that and handle it? And you've come out with a new Apple Pay compatible reader for Square. Can you tell us about the reader itself?
Sure, absolutely. So we announced the product in June with Apple at WWDC, and it is a new Square card reader, works for NFC and EMV, and is the next generation of our card reader, the most powerful yet. We tried to capture the original magic of the first card reader that really broke through a lot of barriers for small businesses, and also innovate and understand that people are going to be using credit cards and phones in a new way to pay. And you see that encapsulated in the simplicity of the product, the accessibility of the product. We're offering 250,000 of them for free, knowing that accessibility is a huge barrier to entry for all businesses to accept credit cards.
How many? Do you know how many merchants or how many users you have on Square right now, roughly?
We do, but we don't say. It's a sizable number, and there are, you know, 30 million or so small businesses in the U.S. alone. It's the lifeblood of the economy. It's a giant market, undiscovered still in some ways.
Just to say it, you used to talk about the fact. I remember at one point, I don't know, it was 5 or 6 million users a few years ago, and you know what was significant about that was you know, it took Visa and MasterCard 30 years to get to 8 million merchants. So you guys must be at least that by now. But
that's right. It's a great example of not thinking about necessarily the total addressable market as someone else has defined it, but really changing what the addressable market is.
Exactly. Now, you're obviously bullish on NFC or this near-field contactless technology that's embedded in the new iPhones. It's been embedded in most of the other major handsets for some time now. Allows you to use your phone to tap and pay. What is for those that aren't familiar with NFC? What's the benefit of using an NFC chip in a phone? And in the Square Reader from a payments perspective.
That's a great question. I'll talk about two different things. So first, I think most people. Within the American market, realized that contactless payments prior to Apple Pay were essentially nowhere. Many small attempts, mediocre attempts, failed attempts by the card brands and others to bring NFC. And I think that Magstripe's low cost and ease of use was a barrier. Those things are very attractive. Customers like low cost and ease of use. The imminent liability shift in the U.S., I think, changed that story. With what I'd call a mediocre carrot and a mediocre stick for making a technology transition. And Apple told a much bigger story, which is that customers will be able to carry around contactless payments on hundreds of millions of phones coming soon. So that landscape has really shifted. Why it's better, you have to focus on the things that made Magstripe successful. Low cost, easy accessible hardware for buyers, and then for sellers. And then for buyers, the story is all about security and authenticated payment types. We believe that customers can and should insist on paying with authenticated payment types. They don't always know why it's important, but we think that they should, and we want to make it easy for merchants to accept those payments. And what I mean by authenticated are things that are unique one time or backed by biometrics, or we'll see dozens of innovations over time about what makes payment types authenticated, but buyers should be insisting on this. And when they come into a small store, we don't want that small store owner to say, "I don't know what you're talking about." We want them to say, "Of course I accept that."
I guess most people don't realize that even though the Magstripe has been around for 30 years, it's actually not very secure anymore. And the U.S. has a much higher fraud rate than the rest of the world because we still rely on that. So, it's got to change. Apple made the most obvious move, but it's been great to see, people embracing this. Here's my question to you. How do we get this behavioral shift? People are used to pulling out a plastic card. They've been doing this for a long time. How do we get them to feel comfortable around tapping their phone or using contactless technology more generally?
I think you have to do two things. First, there has to be value in it for the buyer, and I think that value is going to come in the form of security. They will see less compromise. They will see easier reprovisioning. They will see their banks and issuers issuing platforms for them to be successful when they walk around, and they don't have to walk around with a card that has their 16 digits printed on the front of the card. So that's the buyer piece of it. I think our responsibility is to make the purchasing experience fast and easy. One of the things that is really working in NFC's favor is that EMV is slow. It's not only slow, but the ritual of putting in a card and waiting and then typing and then waiting and then getting some indication that you should remove a card is pretty much the wrong ritual in any mobile environment. It's marginal on a countertop, but it's really not the right gesture for a transaction. Tapping is a lot more sensible. Swiping's pretty good, but if you combine both the buyer value and the seller value of tapping, it's really going to win. And Apple's choice to pick a standard way to do that, I think, was the kind of final blow to get it over the top.
Yeah. Hey, Robert, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
So here's a question for you, and then you might, you know, and Jesse, you might respond to this as well. But, you know, given the U.S. has led in so many areas when it comes to technology development in such, you know, particularly out of Silicon Valley, why is it that we're so far behind on payments tech in the United States?
Because of the infrastructure investment it requires. You know, we're not a little tiny country where you can drive across the country easily. And there's also very entrenched big businesses who are resisting change. And until we see those two things get ameliorated, it's going to be tough to really see the kinds of innovative change that we're seeing in Europe, where they have touchless payments cards now, and in Asia, where they're going to just leapfrog everything and go straight to a mobile phone economy. And we're seeing new kinds of payment systems and new kinds of e-commerce systems come about in places like India very quickly. I just interviewed the head of product at Flipkart, for instance, which is India's number one e-commerce system. And he said, you know, a year ago, only 15% of its business was being done on mobile phones. And today, 70% of its business is being done on mobile phones. So in 1 year, they've had a complete transformation of their business. And we just don't see that kind of rapid shift here in the United States. It's been a more gradual shift.
Yeah, yeah. Businesses like Alibaba, of course, are dominantly mobile now in places like China. So, hey, you know, Jesse, you guys have got presence in places like Japan. Are you deploying this reader in you know, outside of the U.S. as well?
Eventually, we'll see technology like this everywhere we go, but no immediate schedule for you.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. You know, in respect to the security aspects and stuff like that, obviously the whole NFC thing, the greatest weakness in the existing system is that 16-digit PAN, or the, you know, personal number you have on your card. But, you know, what sort of security features are built into this?
It's really at the core of EMV and NFC technology themselves. It's unique identifiers, cryptographically different between transactions, easily revocable in a cloud-based point-of-sale system. Really a lot of good things that the industry has developed over the last couple of decades that we see worldwide. You know, Magstripe cards are not only easy to read the 16 digits off the front, they're actually pretty easy to build. So if you do get someone's personal information, you can make a Magstripe card. That's not the case with contactless and EMV. It's a much higher barrier to entry for those. And that's all... That's all the baseline, you know, at Square, because we are the master merchant and run the point of sale and run the reporting and run the analytics and can see the entire system. We have much more sophisticated ways to protect our customers and identify bad actors and take good action. So we're not totally dependent on the card technology itself, but it is nice that it raises the floor.
So once this sort of becomes ubiquitous or it's out there, you know, what else is happening in the ecosystem to support Square customers that you know, is going to, you know, take this to the next level, particularly for SMEs and so forth that are using it?
Sure. What I like about the power of this reader and the way it connects to Square is that it is an ecosystem. So when you can connect digitized payments securely for buyers into the point of sale, you can connect to the point of sale, which logically connects to the reporting of the merchant's business, which logically connects to analytics on how their business is doing and gives them an opportunity and an opportunity to provide them marketing and financial services based on that analytics. So once all of this is in the digital domain, off we go. One of the biggest liabilities for cash for a merchant is not only the literal handling of the cash, but they are completely anonymous customers to them. They have no opportunity to talk to them, they have no opportunity to learn from them, and they have no opportunity to offer them something in the future. So moving to a sensible digital platform on both sides of the counter, which is something I think we do uniquely, is a great opportunity.
So where did the acquisition of Keely, is the Toronto-based firm, fit into this?
So it fits in very well with our philosophy of how to build a payment system. Like I said, the litany from payments to point of sale to reporting to analytics, it's about being responsible for the full stack of the merchant's experience. And if you take that to its logical conclusion all the way down to the hardware, it means taking ownership of the bits of hardware and software that operate this system. And if we can take ownership of that, we can prioritize things like size and power and speed, something that EMV and NFC technology was not really built for. This was architected a long time ago based on a standard. It was built for countertop systems that are bolted to the counter and plugged into the mains. And it's a different world. It's a mobile payments environment. And none of these platforms are built for mobile. So if we can take more ownership and responsibility for how we engineer all the way at the bottom, we can prioritize the things that are important to us.
So where can I get one of the new Square readers?
They will be easy to get. You'll be able to get them at squareup.com, easily found on our page when you sign up. You'll also be able to buy them at Apple Retail and other retailers eventually.
Awesome. So that's sounds like a great partnership you've got there with Apple Pay.
You know, it's the best way to pay meets the best way to sell.
Absolutely. Well, Jesse, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
Great information. And Scobalizer, thanks again for stopping by. Where can people get in touch with you at Rackspace?
Rackspace at facebook.com/Robert Scoble.
Yeah, facebook.com, Robert Scoble. Great. All right, thanks, guys, for joining us. I really appreciate it. Look forward to having you back on the show sometime in the future, Robert. You too, Jesse.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, just a quick sign out. Thanks to our media partners, Inner Tribe at Cyberst. Don't forget, they've got coming up in October their Cyberst event in Singapore, and Finovate Fall, September 16th, 17th, not far away now. So looking forward to that one. That's it for Breaking Banks this week, and I look forward to seeing you guys again next week. That's another show. See you later.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.